Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
A military tragedy reverberates all the way to the top.
It's difficult enough when we lose these brave Americans in battles overseas. It is horrifying that they should come under fire at an army base on American soil.
The commander-in-chief responds to an officer's rampage in Fort Hood, Texas. The military contemplates the enemies within on top of its two active battlefields. The Fort Hood massacre on the morning after. Everyone's looking for a takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, November 6th. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee is off today. The details are beginning to emerge of that tragic story in Fort Hood, and we'll have them for you all morning long here on The Takeaway. Also, we're going to have new unemployment figures that come out this morning, and we've got something about the movies worth watching this weekend. It is a movie weekend in addition to everything else. But first, we spoke as dawn was breaking in Central Texas. It was still dark with Olga Pena, managing editor for the Killeen Daily Herald, to talk about the reaction as this community begins to react to what's being called the worst military shooting spree in U.S. history. Olga Pena set the scene for us when we spoke with her.
Yes, usually in this quiet town, there's no traffic around this time. Suddenly there is, as people prepare to make their way to Fort Hood and get the latest from officials. They're preparing a press conference this morning.
You know, we're going to talk to you a little bit more in a moment, but give us a sense right at the top of how integrated Fort Hood is with the communities surrounding.
The community of Central Texas is unbelievably supportive. This is the type of town where soldiers come home. Some 20,000 are deployed right now to Iraq and Afghanistan. As homecomings begin to happen, which are scheduled to begin next week for the 1st Cavalry, you see the whole community come out to the main gate to welcome these soldiers.
And certainly the whole community is reverberating with the events of yesterday. The news conference that Olga Pena referred to has taken place, and we'll have all of that information in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning, a press conference has been going on in Fort Hood, Texas, as I mentioned, to give the latest on the shooting there. 13 people killed, at least 30 wounded. Many of the wounded had to undergo surgery, and the suspected shooter, Army psychiatrist Nidal Malik Hassan, is on a ventilator in the hospital on base. In the past few minutes, The Takeaway spoke to head of media relations at Fort Hood. He said 28 of the wounded are still hospitalized, but all in stable condition. He said the base is currently notifying families of the dead and injured. He said this will take, quote, a long and involved process. In other news, President Obama will visit Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington later today. The White House says this visit was planned before yesterday's shooting. The president is also expected to sign a bill that will extend unemployment benefits for up to 20 weeks. The measure also provides tax incentives to first-time homebuyers. We're going to get the unemployment rate for the month of October a little later this morning. In about a half hour, the Labor Department will release that number and we'll bring it to you. In other news, the World Health Organization says most flu cases around the world are the H1N1 swine flu strain. The WHO's top flu official says in some countries, under 70% of the viruses being tested are H1N1. Wall Street was on fire yesterday, and the Dow kicks off above 10,000 at 10,006. What do military families need to know about civilian life and vice versa? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. A tragedy reverberating in two parallel universes on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm flying solo this morning. Celeste has the day off. But let's begin with the story in Fort Hood, Texas. This is what we believe to be true at this hour. At about 1:30 yesterday, a man by the name of Major Nidal Malik Hassan allegedly walked into the Soldiers Readiness Processing Center and the Howes Theater at Fort Hood in Central Texas and opened fire using two handguns. One was a semi-automatic weapon. Eventually, he was shot, and now Major Nidal Malik Hassan is in a hospital at Fort Hood, Texas, and we believe that he is on a ventilator at this hour. 13 dead when the shooting ended. 30 wounded, many of them still hospitalized as of this morning. The reaction began immediately yesterday in Fort Hood and in Central Texas and around the United States as service members learned what had happened in Fort Hood and as American civilians learned how this could happen on an American military base. And, of course, those shots at Fort Hood reverberated around the world. We spoke earlier this morning with Specialist Naveed Ali Shah, who is an active American Muslim service member who is on duty at Joint Base in Balad in Iraq, north of Baghdad. And he was thrilled to hear from us this morning.
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Let me just quote your Twitter stream yesterday. I hope none of the shooters turn out to be soldiers or worse for me, Muslim soldiers. Muslims are not all radicals. Then a pause. Too late, you write. What was going on in your mind as you watched the events unfold halfway around the world?
During that particular tweet, I guess you'd say, I was watching CNN, and that was right at the moment when they announced his name and said that he was a recent Muslim convert. And I was just thinking that, you know, this is going to cast another negative stereotype towards Muslim soldiers and, you know, stereotypes that I don't think are accurate at all.
And, you know, there's lots to talk about in this news story, but I would say the headline for you is, what are the implications for Muslim soldiers throughout the world in U.S. uniforms, right?
Right. And, you know, for the most part, since I've been in the military for almost 3 years now, I've never experienced any sort of, you know, discrimination or stereotyping from any of my fellow comrades. You know, they've all been welcoming and, you know, more than curious about my religion, just, you know, asking questions about it, and I'm happy to fill them in. But when events like this happen, it does, you know, cast a dark shadow over it, and for a while things, you know, it seems like I feel a little embarrassed, to say the least.
Well, Specialist Naveed Ali Shah has nothing to be embarrassed about, to say the least. He is on active duty. We spoke with him earlier this morning at Joint Base Balad in Iraq, north of Baghdad. American Muslims all over the United States and service members all over the world reacting to the events at Fort Hood. We're joined now by Specialist Sidney Silverthorne, who left Fort Hood 2 days ago, headed to Fort Benning in Georgia. Specialist, good morning.
Hello.
And Olga Pena joins us. She's managing editor of the newspaper there in Central Texas, in Killeen, Texas, which has been covering this since the story broke at 1:30. The news conference within the hour brought us up to date on a few issues. Can you review the details that we learned as military officials faced reporters about 50 minutes ago?
Absolutely. We now know that 90% of the families of the victims who were wounded have been notified. All of those wounded are in stable condition. And I just heard from our reporter there on post that we do have a name to that hero, civilian Fort Hood police officer who gunned down Hassan. Her name is Kimberly Munley, M-U-N-L-E-Y, and she is in stable condition.
And she's a military police officer or one of the civilians who came on base?
She is a civilian Fort Hood police officer. They
Wow.
are sort of contract workers out of Fort Hood, but a civilian.
And when you say she's a hero, do we know any of the circumstances of how Major Hassan, who's the suspect here, the alleged suspect here, was apprehended?
Well, Colonel Braverman, that is the Darnell Army Medical Center commander, has stated that the initial shooting wounded all these people and killed some was about 10 minutes that time period. And during that time period, Ms. Lee, that Fort Hood police officer, shot him very quickly, ending what could have been a much more tragic event.
All right. The Specialist Sidney Silverthorne is with us. How does something like this reverberate on the base that you left 2 days ago?
It's very shocking, honestly. It's very, very shocking. I can't completely say that I haven't thought about it before.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, you know, Fort Hood is the largest military base that we have. So just knowing that and being there kind of makes you think, like, well, if somebody did want to do something, you know, this is a large installation. But I'm hearing from the news that, you know, it wasn't a terrorist attack. They're still trying to figure out what was actually behind it, what he was thinking, stuff like that.
Well, you know, we do know that the suspect was an MD, a psychiatrist who actually counseled soldiers.
Exactly.
Have you ever been counseled by a psychiatrist in the military, and possibly even this Major Nidal Malik Hassan?
No, I've never been counseled by him. I have been to counseling since I've been in the military, but it hasn't been post-traumatic stress related. I've never deployed before. I was scheduled to deploy,
right,
but I got pregnant.
But how? What kind of a chilling sensation does that give you, knowing that an actual therapist, a counselor like this, could be responsible for such a thing?
It's very chilling. It's very chilling, especially because in order for me to leave post, I actually had to get a clearing stamp from that building. So I was just in that building a couple of days before I left.
Really? Have you managed to talk with any of your colleagues on base since?
Yeah, I've called everybody. I've talked to everybody. Everybody that I know in Fort Hood is safe and okay.
What are they saying about the events? What did they tell you?
They're just saying, you know, well, I talked to them yesterday while they were on lockdown, and they were just saying, you know, they couldn't believe it, and they were basically making comments like somebody went crazy. When I was talking to them, they didn't really know what was going on. I had more information than they did because I was off post,
right,
looking at the news while I was talking to them.
And we were getting all kinds of conflicting information. Specialist Sydney Silverthorne talking about the events unfolding at Fort Hood, a base that she left just 2 days ago. You know, forgive me if I'm off base here, a specialist. But when you say this came to your mind before, are you talking about the vulnerability of soldiers at a place like Fort Hood? Or are you talking about a place where people are walking around at the breaking point where something like this you can imagine happening?
I can definitely imagine it happening. And the reason why I say that is because Fort Hood is a high deployment readiness base. We are always combat ready, whether it's 4th ID on one side or 1st Cavalry Division on the other side. Those two divisions, the two major divisions that we're out for, is they deploy, you know, they go to overseas for a year, they come back for a year. They go overseas for a year, they come back for a year. So we have soldiers over there that have deployed 3 and 4 times since they've been at Fort Hood. So the morale is kind of low.
Wow.
If you're not in the process of getting out the Army, or in the process of going to a new duty station, you're kind of stuck.
Specialist Sydney Silverthorne, thanks so much for being with us. She left Fort Hood 2 days ago, has been in touch with friends at Fort Hood who certainly were close to what happened yesterday. Olga Pena, who's also with us, managing editor for the Killeen Daily Herald. Did you hear a quote in what the Specialist Silverthorne was saying there?
Absolutely. And one of the things that she mentioned is how deployable this base is. Let me give you some perspective. Currently, right now, there are 20,000, more than 20,000 troops that are deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan just from Fort Hood.
Wow.
These are families who are dealing with a great deal of loss, separation, and we are constantly having press conferences with Army officials that are trying to get more and more health specialists, behavioral health specialists, psychiatrists and psychologists to Fort Hood because the need is so great and really the demand is too high to meet right now.
Well, talk about what does Specialist Silverthorne just said seconds ago, that morale is low at Fort Hood, the largest combat base in the United States. Does that jive with your reporting? We just have a few seconds.
Well, absolutely. Just here recently, in the last few months, they built a new spiritual readiness center so they can try to tackle the morale that is stated to be low as people have back-to-back deployments.
Wow. Well, there is an extraordinary takeaway. Olga Pena, managing editor for the Killeen Daily Herald, talking about the difficulties coming up with counseling options for soldiers deploying and redeploying at Fort Hood. That could possibly be a detail that emerges as very, very significant in the aftermath of the worst shooting spree on a U.S. military base in U.S. history. We also spoke with Specialist Sydney Silverthorne, who left Fort Hood 2 days ago on her way to Fort Benning in Georgia. More details as they emerge here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We've already had reaction from the White House to the events at Fort Hood yesterday, where 13 people were killed and 30 people at least wounded when an American Muslim officer, a major, went into a facility at Fort Hood and began shooting with two handguns, one a semi-automatic handgun. More reaction now from far away from Fort Hood. We've heard from people on the base. We've heard from active service members in Iraq reacting to the events of yesterday. Kate Daly joins us now, health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com. She's at her home in New York City. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
We spoke earlier this morning and are continuing a discussion with Ibrahim Hooper with the Council on American Islamic Relations, who's on the line with us from Virginia. Good morning, Ibrahim Hooper.
Good morning.
Our own Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, is here in the studio and in the New York area.
Good morning.
Muslim Americans, American Muslims, are reacting to what's going on. What are your friends saying to you, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen?
I think everyone is just shocked that this occurred. And a lot of folks that I know personally have family that's also in the military. And so it's the same thing where you're like, what would have happened if this had happened to a member of my family? And how do I feel right now? So some of the people that we've heard from that have called in, that we've talked to, just starting to feel that personal tinge of like, this is scary. You know, this is a scary situation. And of course, as Muslims, people are going to start to point to us and say that this is a Muslim thing, and it's really not.
And what is the infrastructure that exists among American Muslims in the United States of support groups, people who can reach out, other than just your own Rolodex and your own little black books of friends that you always call in situations like
Frankly,
this?
Frankly, that's one of the failings of the American Muslim community, is that there's not enough of a good mental health institutions to support Muslims that need support. So I think that you're pointing out something that is a weak part in the community.
Ibrahim Hooper with the Council on American Islamic Relations, would you agree with that, that in many ways, in many communities, Muslims are on their own when something like this happens?
Yeah, unfortunately, as a minority religious community, we don't have the real infrastructure that we should have in terms of support on mental health issues or even other issues like domestic violence and these kinds of things. It's something we're working on. As the Muslim community grows and matures, these things are being addressed. But obviously, at least in this case, it wasn't addressed sufficiently.
All right. Again, the suspect in this case, Major Nidal Malik Hassan, an American Muslim. We've heard from family members who say they were shocked that this even happened. He's in a hospital, believed to be on a ventilator. So there's no word from the suspect himself. Kate Daly, how are families going to be, in an organized way, beginning to react to either deaths in their family or the being wounded on base in such a circumstance?
Well, when we're talking about military families, we have to recognize that they're already living in kind of a heightened state of emotional stress. You know, there's the stress of wondering whether or not their husbands and wives are going to be deployed. There's maybe the stress of living with someone who has returned from deployment and has their own PTSD issues. So to add this on top of all the other kind of psychological stressors that are currently being put on our military families is going to make recovery a lot more difficult.
Well, Kate Daly, as health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com, you point out something that we've been noting all morning here on the program, and that is there is a parallel universe in the United States. There is the military world that experiences these events in its way. And then there is a civilian world that is sort of sitting on the couch observing these events from a distance as they unfold in the media. And we've been getting some responses all morning long of people who are responding to this parallelism and responding to the fact that the suspect in the case is believed to be an American Muslim. Here are two reactions that we've already received this morning.
My name is Mike. I'm calling from North Jersey. I don't think anybody should take into account this person's religion. I don't believe that's really a factor. Too many people want to focus on that and make that part of the issue, when reality is it's really most of the time never part of the issue. It's just somebody just does something that for some reason or another nobody can explain, that they do something they shouldn't do.
Actually, I think it's just the opposite. It seems like when someone goes out and commits multiple murders like this or some sort of mayhem, that if they're Christian, they're surprised that person did it. And I don't find it surprising at all.
And Nora emailed us, after the tragic shootings at Fort Hood, I'm disappointed to hear John Huckenberry refer to the shooter as a Muslim American. At this point, the morning immediately after the horrible incident, we have no idea if his religion had any influence on his actions. If he'd been a Catholic, would you have felt the need to point it out? Ibrahim Hooper, how do members of the media approach something like this? You said earlier this morning that if it was John Smith, nobody would be asking any of these questions.
The mainstream media is generally pretty good on these issues. I mean, I've been a journalist myself, and you have to report on what's out there. When it popped up that his name sounded Muslim, you had to report on that. When find out that he worshipped at this mosque or worshipped at that mosque and had these views posted online, these things are reported. But what we see all too often is now there's kind of a Islamophobia machine, particularly on the internet, on talk radio, on the right-wing talk radio, and it generates this hatred towards Islam and Muslims, exploiting these kinds of incidents.
And we should point out that we haven't heard anything of that kind in any of the public media this morning. When I say public, I don't mean public broadcasting. I do mean, the media that we would be tuning into. But you have received hate messages, Ibrahim Hooper, with the Council on Islamic American or American Islamic Relations. Kate Daly, we also heard on this morning's program, and we don't have a whole lot of time, but that there is a shortage of infrastructure for counseling families, military families, both at Fort Hood and in the military generally. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, these reports that this man was also a psychiatrist are reports about military chaplains, the people who are supposed to help support these families, themselves having PTSD because they're hearing so many stories. They don't have the mechanisms to help, and there isn't a support system for the people who are providing support. So that's something else to take into account when you're looking at what might have gone on in Fort Hood.
Kate Daly, health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com, talking about how families are going to be responding to this and the apparent shortage, or at least it needs to be addressed, to the availability of counseling infrastructure for people in the military. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, normally you're our sports contributor, but this is a moment to reflect and teach both American civilians and people who are not Muslim Americans how to respond here. I think most Americans would say, I know how to respond. I'm tolerant. I don't hate people just because of their religion. But what goes through your mind?
I mean, when we had spoke about earlier about the mental health capability or facilities for American Muslims, and you have a psychiatrist who has a Muslim name.
Yeah.
It kind of points to that irony. It also comes to mind, it's just that my name is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. What are people thinking about me?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Thanks to Ibrahim Hooper with the Council on American Islamic Relations, also Kate Daly, and of course, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. A bit of a shocker from the Labor Department moments ago. The unemployment rate has solidly into double digits now. It was expected to inch up towards 10%, but the Labor Department is reporting 10.2%. Markets are reacting to that. There ought to be a negative opening in about an hour on Wall Street. We're going to take those figures apart with Louise Story and with Femi Oke in just a moment. But first, on the developments at Fort Hood, Texas, where a shooter killed 13 people and wounded at least 30, we go now to Erica Aguilar from KUT in Fort Hood. We had a news conference within the hour, Erica. First of all, give us the latest.
Sure. So they confirmed we do have one dead overnight. So now we have 13 dead and 28 people have been hospitalized. This shooter, Major Hassan, is at a civilian hospital. He's on a ventilator, but he is in stable condition. Fort Hood officials aren't disclosing any real detail about, his background or even going into speculation into some of the motives. But they did say that they are going to be calling families of the victims and the people who are hospitalized and who have been affected. They've been interviewing more than 100 people who were at the scene. It was said that there were at least 400 people among soldiers, civilians, and first responders who were at the scene.
Wow.
And go ahead.
That's an enormous number. And again, the notification process that you referred to a moment ago is nearly done. So we're going to start getting public names disclosed of people who were wounded and dead. Erica Aguilar from KUT talking about the latest in the aftermath of the shooting at Fort Hood, Texas. And now, whatever else is going on in the headlines, Richard Hakes will bring us up to date.
And John, as you just mentioned, unemployment rate topped 10% for the first time since 1983. 190,000 jobs lost in October. And as we've been reporting all morning long in a news conference at Fort Hood last hour, officials said many of those hurt in yesterday's shooting rampage have undergone surgery. The Takeaway spoke to the head of media relations at the base. He said 28 people are still hospitalized. All are in stable condition. In other news, the House is expected to vote tomorrow on its health care bill. Earlier on the show, we spoke with House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn. We asked him if there will definitely be a public option in the bill.
Absolutely. We will cover about 96% of Americans in this bill.
The president will be on Capitol Hill tomorrow to rally support for the bill. And the World Health Organization says most flu cases around the world are the H1N1 or swine flu strain rather than seasonal flu.
Those just about in every country in the world.
Yeah,
I was noticing in that report. Richard Hake with the headlines. And, of course, the top headline there is the unemployment rate, 10.2%. The number of people losing their jobs surging into double digits. Louise Story, business reporter for The New York Times, is on the phone looking at the numbers this morning from the Labor Department. And Femi Oke is in our studio with some reporting on the tangible implications of the unemployment rate reaching 10.2% for older workers. First, Louise Story, what do you make of these numbers?
I think this is a real wake-up call, John, because we've been talking about 10% for many, many months. Very few people thought we'd get there this month. They were predicting 9.9%. Sounds like a small difference from 10.2%, but it will have a huge psychological impact on the market. And what this really shows is that the recovery that we're seeing on Wall Street is not reaching much of America.
And it's certainly causing people who are looking for work to transform the ways they're looking at their options. Femi, okay, you spent some time with older workers, a demographic that has lots to worry about in this economic environment.
I spent some time with some older people looking for work, hoping to be workers again. Now, most of them have been unemployed for about a year. So they were at the Labour office, which is not too far away from our studios in Lower Manhattan. And it's called a one-stop shopping for jobs. So basically you get career service and advice and help, maybe rejigging your resume. And I went into the resources room full of computers, printers, everything there is free, available. A lot of the staff in the Labour Department there will help you. Now, I made no judgment about age in the room. I was just looking for people who would talk to me with my tape recorder, basically. But one of the first people I met was Meredith Robinson. She used to be an administrative assistant and she was laid off from JP Morgan just about a year ago.
Right, when the financial meltdown exploded.
Yeah. So she's in this career center very often, and she told me about the number of people who came who were very much like herself.
When you look around the room sometimes, you see a lot of people in their 40s and 50s, and you're like, where are the young people? Did they lay any young people off? I hate to call myself middle-aged, but it seems like a lot of middle-aged people are out of work.
Hey, Louise Story, did they lay any young people off this week or this month in the statistics?
I haven't been all through the statistics, but we have been seeing for many months that it's hurting older workers who are not, you know, viewed as flexible as younger workers, and they're certainly not as cheap in many cases as younger workers.
Interesting. How are older workers, Femi, changing their whole strategy for looking for work because they're faced with these realities that they may never get another job?
Well, I was with about 20 people yesterday, and they felt seriously overqualified.
Overqualified.
Their resumes were too big, too chunky. Employers wouldn't want to even look at their resume. For instance,
usually you pad your resume by adding things. What are these people doing?
Yes, they're taking details out, making their resumes look a little younger, a little fresher. For instance, it's something that Janet Wright has considered. She hasn't had a job interview for a year.
I'm 58. I've been working since I was 14. I have a lot of experience, and the more experience you have, it's not good.
The more experience you have, it's not good. Again, Louise was saying a moment ago, if you have a lot of experience, you were paid at a higher rate, and nobody wants to hire you because they think you're too expensive.
You know what else else is really interesting in here, as we're talking, I'm going through the numbers.
Sure.
And the rate for adult men is significantly higher than the rate for adult women. So we see that it's 10.7% unemployment for adult men, and it's 8.1% for adult women.
That is huge.
It's huge. That seems like a real divide.
Which might be a positive development for some of the people you talked with, though those were two women we heard from a moment ago, Femi.
Yeah, indeed. And just to give you an idea of what's happening in New York State, last year, 250,000 people were unemployed. This year, 800,000
wow,
are unemployed. So employers actually have a lot of choice. So one of the things that some of these older job seekers are trying to do is to work out, well, how flexible can I be? How do they even know if an employer will employ them? And Janet had a bit of a strategy. She was looking...
What's her name?
Janet Wright.
Right.
She had a strategy for working out how I can actually get employed. Here it is.
The quote word is self-starter, you know, like someone out of college or with 2 or 3 years experience. When you look at the ads, they want people right out of college so they could pay them less. Then if you agree to take less than you were making, they don't believe you. You know, they're like, why would you want to do that? But you just need a job.
Wow, a dilemma for older workers. Again, those are three female voices. Femi, okay, thanks for that. Louise Story, is there any option for older workers to self-start? Is that going to get them out of this 10.2% unemployment rate? A couple of seconds.
You know, we got to drill into these numbers a lot more. I think part of this could be perception. As I'm looking at this, we see that actually...
quickly.
It's lower for some of the older people. I'm looking at the 7.8%.
Well, keep looking for signs of hope in there. All right, Louise Story, business reporter for the New York Times, 10.2% unemployment rate. We're looking at the numbers. Good morning, everyone. Joining us now is Angela Huebner, Associate Professor of Human Development and Marriage and Family Programs at Virginia Tech University, joining us from Falls Church, Virginia this morning. In 2007, in April of 2007, a shooting at Virginia Tech University killed 32 people. Angela Huebner, we don't want to necessarily relive that tragic event, but as we think about the events at Fort Hood, Texas, and the reactions and the sort of emotional consequences of people down at Fort Hood, based on your research and your experience, what are the most important things that therapists need to bear in mind in the early going here?
Well, I think the biggest thing at this point, John, is to help families think about normalcy and safety so that they can help to reassure families that they are safe at this point. That's, I think, the biggest first step.
And that's the hardest argument to make at this point. This was a person on base who was actually employed as a counselor, as a psychiatrist.
Exactly.
So the therapists have their work cut out for them. We talked with
they absolutely do. Yes.
We talked with a service member on base who said morale is low and that there is a shortage of infrastructure for counselors. In that situation, it's even more challenging.
Well, right, and that's something that that the military has really been working on in the past years, you know, to try to increase infrastructure. But it is difficult. It's a challenging time with the number of deployments and the need for mental health care and just the shortage.
Now, we don't want to theorize here, but one could extract from the fact that this major, who's the suspect, who is a psychiatrist, who was worried about his own deployment, could have snapped because of the stress, not of his deployment, but of dealing with the counseling stress that he has in dealing with individuals. Does that make any sense to you? What do you go through when you deal with the stress counseling?
Well, I think it's possible, and as you said, I think it is too soon to, you know, to figure out if that's exactly what happened to this gentleman. But there's a whole field called vicarious trauma or vicarious stress, and that's certainly a part of what you learn how to deal with when you do therapy in those types of settings. How to listen and be present for the client without getting caught up in the story.
But
so
there is a danger.
There are ways to do that.
But there is a danger of getting caught up in the story.
Absolutely, and that's why it's really important for mental health care workers to monitor themselves, to have good supervision, you know, to have a support group for themselves, which most do. You know, that's part of the system, and that's why. I mean, it's a very important piece so that people can kind of monitor each other, their colleagues, and make sure everybody's online.
And if there's a shortage of counselors for active soldiers, there must be maybe even more of a shortage of counselors for the counselors.
Right, exactly. It's a trickle-down sort of thing.
Well, that is really, really disturbing. Do you think there are issues that are different for military families than for civilians?
Well, there's some research now going on, and just the military is really trying to address this, is what I'm seeing. But yes, there are issues in terms of accessing service and the stigma attached to seeking mental health services. And again, to their credit, they're trying to change that, the stigma of if I seek mental health services, then I'm broken or I'm not deployable, or that has right. an impact on my career, because if I can't deploy, I can't get promoted, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, and
so it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's seek treatment, but if you do, there are potentially some repercussions, or at least perceived repercussions.
And all of those tensions can work their way up the chain and create the circumstances that make an event of yesterday at Fort Hood possible. Angela Huebner, Associate Professor of Human Development and Marriage and Family Programs at Virginia Tech University. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee is off today. So what are the windows into the military life that might explain what happened at Fort Hood? It's difficult for civilians to understand what goes on in the military, and in a sense, there are parallel universes between military families and civilian families. But coming up, movies may be a bridge. Rafer Guzman will be here, The Takeaway's movie critic. But first, Richard Hake is here with a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour.
And John, we just learned this past hour that the unemployment rate has surpassed 10% for the first time since 1983. The Labor Department reports it stands at 10.2%. That comes as an additional 190,000 jobs were lost last month. The latest figures from yesterday's shooting in Fort Hood, Texas, are 13 dead and at least 30 injured. Officials say many of those hurt in the shootings underwent surgery. All are in stable condition. In a news conference earlier this morning from Fort Hood, Colonel John Rossi says they are taking extra precautions at the base after the shooting.
We are operating at a heightened level of security, and we'll continue to do so until we determine to bring it back to normal operations. We are fully confident in the security of this installation.
Meanwhile, the suspected shooter in the case, Army psychiatrist Nidal Malik Hassan, is in the hospital being treated for multiple gunshot wounds. He's also on a ventilator. Other stories. Overseas in Afghanistan, NATO says two coalition service members are missing in the country's west. NATO says extensive search and rescue operations are underway to locate them. And looking ahead to later today, President Obama is expected to sign a bill that will extend unemployment benefits for up to 20 weeks. The measure also provides some tax incentives for first-time homebuyers.
That's good news for the 10.2 unemployed
exactly.
that you reported there at the top, 10.2%. Those are the stories that we are following this morning, including the aftermath of the shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, and our partner, the New York Times, has a reporter, Michael Brick, on the scene. Good morning, Michael.
Morning, John.
The news conference gave us some details of what we're learning. Apparently, the notification process for families of wounded and dead is almost complete. We may learn some of those names later on today. What are you seeing at this moment?
Satellite City at the base. It's kind of a surreal scene in a military town's generally are small and quiet with nothing to do. And on the outskirts of the base that continues this morning, people are jogging. And around the base itself, there's just a ton of satellite trucks.
Do you think that the presence of the media there, and of course newspaper reporters are not as visible as satellite trucks, but do you think this huge presence, this satellite city that you're talking about, increases the stress of people on base? Have you managed to talk to any of them? What are your impressions?
The atmosphere was pretty, I don't want to call it collegial, but almost collaborative last night when soldiers and their families were on opposite sides of the locked gates. A lot of them were coming to people in the satellite trucks for information and vice versa. A pretty open, welcoming, but tense, obviously.
You know, I can share some notes with you, reporter to reporter. We talked with some people who were either on base recently at Fort Hood or were on base at the time of the shooting, and we're getting a pattern of sort of sketchy impressions that there was a fairly wide perception that morale is low at Fort Hood. and that the availability of psychological counseling and even the counselors themselves experience a shortage of so-called behavioral infrastructure, behavioral options to help them through difficult times. Have you heard anything like this?
It's an interesting question. I haven't really been pursuing that angle, but obviously the military is stressed to its limits, fighting two wars and trying to manage its resources is not an easy job.
And finally, any details you could tell us about the suspect at this point? We learned he's on a ventilator. That was about the only thing I could glean from the news conference earlier today.
I think the whole world is waiting to talk to him, to the point that if you watch local news in Killeen, they're playing over and over every video snippet they can of him walking in and out of a 7-Eleven. Totally irrelevant.
Which gives you an indication of how much more information we're going to need to put this into context. Michael Brick is doing it for the New York Times down there in Fort Hood, in Killeen, Texas. Fort Hood, one of the largest active combat facility for the U.S. military, where soldiers deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan and return from Iraq and Afghanistan by the tens of thousands. Thank you to Michael Brick. Now, Rafer Guzman joins us, film critic for Newsday. And originally, of course, we invited you in here to talk about the movies that are opening.
Right.
But in the hours you've had to stand around and wait to see if we had room for you in the program, actually, as it is for anybody reacting to this Fort Hood situation, movies are a way that civilians actually get a sense of the experience of the military.
Sure, exactly. There are two that are coming up in the next few weeks or so that are going to, I think, touch at least indirectly on the aftermath of a fallen soldier.
And that's not to say that there's a movie being rushed into production about incident right now.
No, this is not Law and Order.
Right.
The first movie that's coming out in a couple weeks, or I think maybe it's November 13th, so that's a week from now.
Right, right, right.
That's with Woody Harrelson. It's supposed to be a great film, a real comeback role for him. It's called The Messenger. You talked about the notification process for telling families that their loved ones has died. That's what this movie's all about.
Here's the trailer.
You do not speak with anybody other than the next of kin. No friend, no neighbor, or mistress.
We're racing Fox, CNN, what have you. We got to be first.
Avoid physical contact. In case you feel like offering a hug or something, don't.
I'm not going to be offering any hugs.
Wow. Really does feel like it's taken right from the headlines.
Yeah, and of course, in the movie, the other officer, the younger officer played by Ben Foster, does in fact start offering hugs, and that's when some of the drama comes into the film.
And we've already heard on the program that therapists have to be, and these aren't therapists here, but still people involved in this emotional care have to be vigilant about their own psychological makeup as they live close to the edge of this.
Right. There's another film that's coming out a few weeks later called Brothers with Tobey Maguire and Jake Gyllenhaal, and that's about one brother who is shipped off to Afghanistan and is believed to be dead in the war, but comes back after being tortured, and of course he's undergoing a psychological maelstrom of his own as well.
Well, here's a trailer for Brothers.
Sam's dead.
What happens when you think your husband is gone?
Uncle Tommy, wake up.
Our dad's dead. He knows. He's his brother.
I cut my throat to bring him back, Dad.
And you begin to put your life together again.
Hello?
But you were wrong about one thing.
I want to talk to my wife.
What's a track record? I mean, I don't know, listening to that trailer, I don't know whether to be revolted or to embrace it. I mean, what's the track record of Hollywood giving a window on the military experience?
I mean, certainly in recent years, not great. I mean, I think, movies that have gotten really a good critical reception, like, say, The Hurt Locker, which was a very, very intense film about the Iraq War.
And there's a scene in Hurt Locker which comes to mind this morning of after a very stressful event, the soldiers go and release their tensions by fighting.
That's right. They go release their tensions by fighting. There's also a scene in that film where one of the soldiers, two of the soldiers actually talk about killing
That's right.
One of the other soldiers
right.
in the film.
That's right. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. I think,
again, we're not trying to cast any aspersions on soldiers, but it does give you a sense of the stresses.
It does. It does. And I think Hollywood has tried to tread a very fine line with these movies by trying to acknowledge the problems of the Middle East wars that we're fighting, but at the same time not vilify the army, as Hollywood, I think, did back in the 60s mm-hmm. and the 70s in the Vietnam and post-Vietnam era.
And I think, you know, you had politically motivated movies about Vietnam. You had almost hagiographic, nationalistic movies about World War II. Isn't it
sure.
interesting that in our era, the narrative is more psychological in the films that you've described?
Yeah, it is. That's true. That's true. And, you know, again, how these two movies we're talking about are going to play at the box office is a big question, especially when things are very raw, I think,
Indeed.
In the public's mind.
Well, will they be a help or a hindrance in understanding what went on at Fort Hood? That's really the question on the table. Rafer Guzman, thanks so much for teeing that up for us.
Thank you.
Rafer Guzman is the film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. And that does it for this hour on The Takeaway. All this morning, we're continuing to keep you up to date with the story from Fort Hood, Texas. Major Nidal Malik Hassan went on a shooting rampage, took 13 lives, at least 30 people wounded. Military families and civilian families, we've just been talking with Rafer Guzman, experience these events and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq in very different ways. Do you think you know enough about your military brothers and sisters and what they're going through at an event like this? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And if you're a military family, inform your civilian brothers and sisters about how to put this event in context. We're talking about movies as a window. Are there any others? Please let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee will be back on Monday. This is The Takeaway. As American as apple pie.
This guy was born and raised here. My cousin. He's a good American. And he, you know, our family is feeling sadness. We feel so much sadness for anybody, any family, for them being hurt. Our condolences go out. We're shocked.
The family of American officer Major Nidal Malik Hassan, accused of killing 13 soldiers at Fort Hood, Texas, yesterday. This morning, families of the dead and more than 30 wounded contemplate another way to die for your country. Men and women in uniform, in mourning, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, November 6th. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee is away this morning. In today's program, all the latest news from Fort Hood. Yesterday, the shooting rampage that's being called the worst in U.S. military history. We'll have it all hour long in the program. We're also going to talk with House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn of South Carolina. He reacts to the events of Fort Hood and also talks about the health care bill that's going to come to a vote sometime over the weekend. We also talk to the author of the novel Push and the screenwriter who developed it into the movie Precious, an unlikely movie, becomes a very, very interesting movie that opens this weekend. But first, we want to catch you up on all the headlines this morning. In the headlines, we just learned this past hour, and it's a blockbuster, that the unemployment rate has surpassed 10% for the first time since 1983. The jobless rate for October rose to 10.2% from 9.8%. Markets are reacting. The futures trading is very, very negative this morning, so Wall Street is expecting a negative open when it gets underway. Trading gets underway in about a half hour from now. Latest figures from yesterday's shooting in Fort Hood, Texas. 13 dead, at least 30 injured. Families of the dead and wounded are being notified. Officials say many of those hurt in yesterday's shooting underwent surgery. 28 are still hospitalized, all in stable condition. That's one positive note. The suspected shooter in the case, Army psychiatrist Nidal Malik Hassan, is in hospital, a civilian hospital, we learn, on a ventilator. In a news conference earlier this morning, the base commander at Fort Hood, Lieutenant General Bob Cohn, said Hassan was not known to be a threat or a risk. Lieutenant General Cohn said it was, quote, counterintuitive that a single shooter could kill so many people, but he said the massacre occurred in close quarters at a readiness center on base. place and near a theater. Later today, President Obama will visit Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington. The White House says this visit was planned before yesterday's shooting. In other news, the president is also expected to sign a bill that will extend unemployment benefits for up to 20 weeks. The measure also provides tax incentives to first-time home buyers. And we've been talking about the battlefield at Fort Hood. Overseas in Afghanistan, NATO says two coalition service members are missing in the west of the country. NATO says extensive search and rescue operations are underway to locate them. Indices on Wall Street were up 2% today, but they're not going to rise this morning. The Dow kicks off today at 10,006. The S&P starts trading at 1067, and the NASDAQ starts at 2105. So we've been posing a provocative question to you this morning in the wake of what's been going on at Fort Hood. Military families and civilian families exist in a kind of parallel universe. Do you think you know enough about what military families go through with two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq? And if you are a military family, tell us what civilians need to know to put in context these events and any other you may care to talk about. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
More disturbing details this morning coming out about the Fort Hood shooting that's being called the worst shooting spree in U.S. military history. 13 dead this morning, 30 wounded. The entire community around Fort Hood is responding to this event. And we've also been asking you to weigh in on it. Civilian and military families experience these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in very, very different ways. We're already getting hints that stress and morale at Fort Hood possibly was at a high level or morale at a low level, and that certainly conditions were ripe for something like this. But we should stress this is a lone gunman acting alone as far as we know. The base commander at Fort Hood in Texas says soldiers who witnessed yesterday's shooting rampage reported the gunman shouted Allahu Akbar, Arabic for God is great, before opening fire. But again, the details are sketchy. What is your reaction to what's been going on today?
My name is Amanda. I live in Brooklyn, New York. My husband's stationed at Fort Hood, Texas. I think the thing that civilian families need to understand about how this experience affects military families is that you learn to balance concern with living your life when your loved one's deployed. And you kind of feel like when they get home, they're going to be safe. So this is, you know, for families who are capable of surviving and functioning during deployments, this is a huge blow because this is a no worrying time. So I think that people need to understand how big a violation this is for us because it's a safe place that they were supposed to be at.
Lots to understand. We talked earlier this morning with Erica Aguilar from KUT in Texas. Erica, what do we know about the suspect in this case?
You know, last night, Lieutenant General Bob Cohn didn't want to release any details. He's very adamant about it. But, you know, everyone's done some really good reporting. We just know that he is an Army psychiatrist. We know that he was on a interview with Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. She was the one who was talking about how he was kind of afraid of going overseas. He had some hesitation and some thoughts beforehand. But, you know, the Fort Hood officials here are really adamant about releasing any kind of details about who exactly Major Hassan is.
And he is an American, and he is an American Muslim, and we've already talked with people on the program who are worried about that sensitivity being inflamed by the events here. I suspect at the news conference later this morning there will be some more said about that.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's when I drove around town just kind of getting a feel of what people are talking about. Talked to this one man who was on base while a lockdown happened late afternoon, and he commented on that. He said, you know, because of, you know, who his ethnicity, who he was, that could be, you know, later inflamed in different media reports.
You know, the fact that he was a psychiatrist, it seems to me, is at least as disturbing as anything related to his ethnicity. I'm wondering what that means. And, you know, we may not know anything about that for quite some time. Erica, stay with us. Matthew Cassis was stationed at Fort Hood in 2007 when he was a private. He joins us now from Vermont. Matthew, is there some sort of culture of tension or danger at the Fort Hood base that it doesn't explain this at all, but it gives it some context?
Oh, no, definitely not. That place is so legit. There's
There's nothing like that ever going on down there.
But are people on edge? I mean, this is a place where people deploy. Is it a kind of an emotional fever pitch at the base? How do people release their energy and their sense of stress?
Usually, it's somewhat negative if the people are going to go deploy or if they're just coming back from a deployment because they don't have many options or luxuries overseas, and when they come back here, they go a little crazy. You know, some people drink, and there's a couple accidents every month or so. I know there's a death clock in front of Fort Hood when you drive to that tells you how many accidents you have, and I haven't seen that thing over 45.
Wow. Now, of course, none of this explains what happened yesterday. You're just trying to get a sense through the eyes of soldiers who might be trying to get back to normal or at least take a pause and reflect on what happened yesterday. Where were you when you learned, and what were your first thoughts as the headlines began to unfold?
I was here when I heard it. My wife told me. She's in Louisiana training. And it's hard to hear something like that. You know, it's bad to hear soldiers attacking other soldiers, and it's just not right. Our war isn't here. It's over there. It shouldn't be here.
All right. Nick Casal joins us. He's a detective first grade and is a former director of counterterrorism for New York City's subway system. Nick, comment, if you would, on, you know, what happened in the media. And again, you know, the media isn't trying to win any awards here. I think they are as reactive and sometimes knee-jerk as ever. But it seemed like there were a lot of very conflicting pieces of information emerging from this. Three shooters, two shooters, one shooter, talking about this is maybe a terrorist attack. Then it wasn't a terrorist attack. Guide us through that a little bit, if you could, Nick.
Well, I guess the first thing you have to realize is, you know, when you go into a critical incident management phase, that the first information that you're receiving from the front is always inaccurate. And you know, when you try to analyze it, you should actually be in more a response mode, and that would be to contain, isolate, and then engage. I think that the military did the correct thing. The base and the military police and civilian police responded within minutes. The base was shut down. I mean, there is a degree of confusion. Everybody is dressed the same. When you have one shooter shooting, the amount of rounds that he did fire in such close proximity, there could be a belief that there's one or more. And again, that is a smart decision by the responders to think that there could be more than one shooter and that there could be a secondary event planned also.
All right, now I'm just theorizing here, but the fact that these were two handguns, one a semi-automatic handgun, at least that was what was told to us last night, certainly does give an indication that this was pretty premeditated. What do you, how do you evaluate a detail like that?
Well, I mean, historically, we've seen in incidents like this, especially in terrorist incidents, you know, you plan for organized terrorist attacks. You cannot plan for that individual who just wakes up that day and decides he is going to commit something based upon his own moral beliefs. I mean, there is no counterterrorism to the individual.
All right. Let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, as we were learning the details, there was a lot of talk about is this a terrorist incident? I was sort of surprised to learn, is there a fairly high degree of vigilance at U.S. military facilities as being targets of terrorist attacks? Is that high on the list?
Well, you have to understand that the base is on alert status because we are at war. And if you drive by any military base, you'll see that the normal conditions have changed drastically by how they deploy both military police and civilian security, armed security guards at the base. But the base, again, is structured against external attack.
All right. Matthew Cassis, you were stationed at Fort Hood in 2007. What does it mean for the base to be on alert?
You can't drive in. You can't do anything wrong. If anything is said to a nature that seems threatening, you're being stopped. It's very uptight down there. You ain't even going to be able to get into the base unless you have credentials.
Erica Aguilar, a reporter in Fort Hood, you talked about cruising through the community and getting some reactions from citizens who, of course, are shocked by this. Can you take us through the timeline of what happened yesterday, the when and the where, and, you know, it's still unfolding even now?
that was everything started about 1:30 p.m. local time, so here in Texas here. That's when it is suspected that Major Hassan did open a fire in the Soldier Readiness Center, which is a processing center, which means that a lot of soldiers around here go there to get medical screenings before and after their deployment. It was said that immediately after he opened fire, he said that a whole bunch of soldiers who were actually on the scene started ripping off their uniforms in order to give first aid to some of the wounded. Some of the soldiers were able to close off the doors about 50 meters away, where there was a college graduation for soldiers who had completed, you know, college. And there were about 600 people in there, but someone was able to shut the doors and keep those people safe. Almost immediately, the place went on lockdown. It was about 5 hours that nobody could go in or out. Checkpoints were completely shut down. And then about 7:05 local time, p.m., here in Texas, that's when that ban was lifted. Family members were able to go in, take their children out of daycare or school if they were in there. And, you know, we waited around for a long while to try to find out what exactly happened. And at the press conference yesterday, Lieutenant General Bob Cohn was saying that he took a little while to finally get out that word, is because he didn't want to, you know, give out any false information. And there was some confusion at the hospital trying to figure out if the man they were treating was, in fact, Major Hassan.
Reporter Erica Aguilar from Fort Hood, Private Matthew Cassis also speaking with us, and Nick Casal, Detective First Grade. Fort Hood, 13 dead, 30 wounded on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's expected sometime tomorrow on Capitol Hill that the Speaker will gavel the House in order and call for a vote on the health care reform bill that has been moving its way through the Congress. Counting the votes and knowing the votes is the job of House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina, who joins us this morning. We had the Minority Whip on the program yesterday, Eric Cantor. First of all, good morning, Congressman Clyburn.
Good morning. How are you?
And let's react first to the events at Fort Hood, Texas. How many military bases are in your district who must be worried and reacting and thinking about what the families are going through down in Central Texas this morning?
Yes, I really am. Fort Jackson, as you know, is in Columbia, my hometown. The base proper is not drawn into my district, but all of the area surrounding the base is. I was born in Sumter, where Shaw Air Force Base is, and the Third Army is being relocated there. You know, in the future, we're going to be having both Army and Air Force on the same property, and we will have that in my birthplace of Sumter going forward. And so I'm very much used to growing up with the military, having suffered through the ups and downs of families who make tremendous sacrifices on behalf of the country. This is just absolutely one of the most incredible events, and it's just so unexpected to have it happen on home turf and from within the ranks.
Well, we should remind people, 13 dead, at least 30 wounded, shooting rampage yesterday at Fort Hood in Central Texas. We're waiting a news conference, which is scheduled within the hour, and we're talking with House Minority Whip Jim Clyburn, who, like many on Capitol Hill, are reacting to the events. Quickly, before we shift to health care, General Cohn on base yesterday described Fort Hood as our home, referring to the men and women in uniform, the tens of thousands who are there, who ship out to Iraq and Afghanistan and who come back through the Fort Hood gates there. It's not feeling like home or a very safe place this morning. Is there anything Congress can do to assure men in the military that these facilities are safe?
Well, you do everything you can to make facilities safe, but there's absolutely nothing any human being can do to prevent this kind of an occurrence. There's obviously mental health problems here, or there could very well be some kind of terrorism act here. Either way, this is the act of a deranged person, and there's not much you can do to prevent that.
And indeed, we don't know much about the suspect who is in the hospital and also in custody, and we may learn more at a news conference at Fort Hood. Let's shift to health care. We asked Eric Cantor yesterday, your colleague on the other side of the aisle, about what's in the minority bill, which has no chance of passage but will be considered at some point over the next several days. But we asked our listeners to come up with things that they want to see in the health care bill, and so I want to put some of those listener suggestions directly to you as you convey to us what is in this bill that is expected to be voted on Saturday. First of all, here's what one of our listeners had to say.
I want to see a health care bill come out that does not mandate health insurance, just lower health care costs.
Jim Clyburn, will there be a mandate in the bill that goes to the floor?
We will have an individual mandate. I don't see how you can possibly do an effective health care bill without having these individual mandates. You know, always people want things to happen, and yet their proposals seem to run contrary to the result they want to see achieve.
Well, Congressman, this next listener who called 8778-MY-TAKE just might be one of your constituents. Listen.
My name is Chuck from South Carolina. We should have a very strong public option. I think there should be absolutely no wiggle room for insurance companies to refuse people for pre-existing conditions, and I think we should get 100% of all Americans covered.
Jim Clyburn, is Chuck going to get his wish?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, and that those two callers tell you a little bit about the social divide that exists in the country on this particular issue. They are asking for exact opposite things, but both of them think that they're exactly right. So that's what we're faced with here, trying to fashion together a piece of legislation that will be effective on behalf of the vast majority of the American people. We must always remember, anytime you're trying to do something like this, when we tried to pass Social Security, it was looked upon as some socialist idea that should never be. But most people think that this is a very successful program. President Johnson went through the same thing with Medicare and Medicaid, and everybody said that was a big government takeover. Now, every place I go, people say, Medicare works. Leave my Medicare alone.
Well, except your colleagues on the other side of the aisle will say, all right, fine, those programs are working, but we've reached a stage now where we can't afford additional penetration into the market of the federal government in health care.
Well, I think we've reached a place where we can't afford not to. People who've seen their premiums doubled over the last 10 years is projected to double again over the next 10 years. Small businesses closing down because they can't afford health care. Individuals, 47 million people without health care. And those of us who do have insurance, we ought to look at our bills when we go out and use this health insurance. We are paying in this cost shifting in the system for all of those people who are not getting
right.
care.
We're talking with House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina. Just to clarify, though, what the listener asked, there will be a public option in this bill, right?
Absolutely.
But you will not be covering 100% of Americans in this bill, right?
We will cover about 96% of Americans in this bill. And you've always got to look at the shift in the changes of jobs and the moving around of people in the system. So I think it would be almost impossible unless you have some kind of a single-payer system, which most people say they don't want to see. You aren't going to get 100% coverage, but we're going to get close to it.
All right, well, here's one more listener before we go.
There's no sense in talking about saving costs until we can clean up all the horrendous fraud in this country. Fraudulent companies, fraudulent providers, clean up the fraud.
Jim Clyburn, are you going to clean up the fraud in this
Absolutely.
Bill?
Absolutely. I am 100% with that lady. She is absolutely correct, and that's why you see this tremendous cut in Medicare on the provider side in this bill. It's kind of interesting. We are trying to squeeze the fraud out of the system. Republicans are sort of criticizing us for these cuts, but we are trying to do exactly what that
right.
man said.
All right. And there'll be a vote tomorrow. You expect any Republican votes?
No, I don't.
Well, he would know. House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn will be there counting all of those votes. Democrat from South Carolina, Majority Whip on health care. There will be a vote on Saturday in the House of Representatives.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we'll have the latest from Fort Hood, including the challenges for psychological counselors in the military. They are real. No pop psychology there. But first, Richard Hake is here with some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour.
Shocking news on the job market this morning. Unemployment has topped 10% for the first time since 1983. 190,000 jobs were lost last month. As we've been reporting all morning, the suspected shooter in the Fort Hood rampage is on a ventilator but is in stable condition. Security remains tight on the base, but the lockdown has been lifted. Matthew Cassis was stationed at Fort Hood in 2008. He told The Takeaway what it's like during a lockdown.
You can't drive in. You can't do anything wrong. If anything is said to a nature that seems threatening, you're being stopped. It's very uptight down there. You ain't even going to be able to get into the base unless you have credentials.
We'll have more on this story coming up next. The House health care bill is expected to go to vote tomorrow. Yesterday, the president got a boost from the AARP, which backed the bill. Abroad, the ousted Honduran leader, Manuel Zelaya, says a power-sharing deal to resolve the country's political crisis has failed. That's after the country's interim president appointed a new unity government without any of Zelaya's representatives. In sports, the Yankees are taking their World Series championship to the streets, New York style. There's a ticker tape parade later today. And finally, the 950th time is a charm. A woman apparently in South Korea has finally passed the written exam for a driver's license after spending $4,200 in near daily attempts to pass the exam. Now she has to pass the actual driving test. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
And then she'll be on the road. Won't that be great? Thank you, Richard Hake. All right, so rejoining us now on the program to talk about the aftermath of the shooting down at Fort Hood in Texas is Olga Pena, managing editor for the Killeen Daily Herald, who joins us from Killeen, Texas. Angela Huebner is an associate professor of human development and marriage and family programs at Virginia Tech. She joins us from Falls Church, Virginia. And Andrew Pomerantz is associate professor of psychiatry at Dartmouth Medical School. He joins us from Florida this morning. Thanks to all three of you for returning. A pattern seems to be emerging here, and I want to talk about it for the next couple of minutes, that possibly the infrastructure available for soldiers under stress in terms of psychological counseling was a little threadbare, and that the Army has been experiencing shortages, and that even the counselors themselves are experiencing stresses that are very, very high. We don't want to prejudge the issues in Fort Hood, but first of all, Andrew Pomerantz, does that sound reasonable to you?
I think there has been a lot in the news recently about the stresses and strains on the caregivers in the military. Military has suffered a lot of losses of psychological counselors over the years. It's been actively recruiting more and has been beefing things up pretty well. We also know a lot more about how to deal with the stresses of deployments, and particularly multiple deployments. But something like this happens, and I think all bets are off.
Hmm. Angela Huebner, what do you think the next few days are going to hold for the community around Fort Hood, Texas, as they attempt to deal with this? And now there's an additional strain on counseling services.
Well, I think it's just going to be a time of trying to reestablish safety, and a time of just unknowns for families, so that they're going to need to know what's possible.
And how do you reestablish that sense of safety?
Well, I think that's difficult to do because what they're seeing is that it's not safe, even though all the assurances are there that, you know, it's an installation. But it's still not necessarily a safe place for them. So families are going to have to come together and reassure their children and just band together.
Olga Pena, are you hearing that from members on base and in the community, that the sense of safety is gone, and that restoring that and with a suspect in custody who was actually a psychological counselor, is that going to be difficult?
Yeah, that's probably the scariest part of this ordeal, is that it was a soldier who was in this profession. And right now, Fort Hood officials are coming off a time period where they had finally reestablished some of that safety, not just with soldiers and their families, but that people in the community were safe to go on post. That right now is going to be something really hard to build up once again.
Andrew Pomerantz, does the sense of safety return if you lock down the base and keep it on alert for an extended period of time?
How Yes and no. I mean, obviously, it's safer than it was. But, you know, as anybody who lived through 9/11 and its aftermath recalls, when your community is threatened and you are locked down and there are troops everywhere and police and everybody's on the lookout, although you're safer, it heightens your arousal and your sense of fear and apprehension. So for now, yes, it's technically a lot safer than it was. But searching for that safety in the one place where people were feeling safe, that's what's important.
Angela, some soldiers, after these events, are going to deploy with the memories fresh in their minds of this shooting. What kind of a liability is that going to be on the battlefield?
Well, I think that's difficult to project. I think the military has worked hard to try to give soldiers outlets to deal with some of those issues before they go. They also have mental health services and counselors embedded in some of the units. So it's not as though when they go and are actually in theater that they don't have access to any services, because they actually do.
Olga Pena, are people in the community talking this out? Are they being candid about this, or is it more of a buttoned-up, bottled-up kind of a feeling on base when you talk to individual service members?
No, absolutely not. Actually, there's a lot of talk on town. A lot of people are surprised that the post is as open as it is at this point. You can still get on post by showing your identification. And as I said, the fear is there, especially considering that we have some 20,000 troops that are scheduled to start returning as early as next week. And so that idea of, well, how are these soldiers going to return? Will they have some post-traumatic stress syndrome? Are we looking forward to more violence?
Angela Huebner, is it a positive that people are being candid and talking about this openly on base? Is that something that tracks towards getting over this kind of thing?
I think absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things, or one of the positive things that can come out of this, is a heightened sense of community. Tragic events like this pull people together and make people bond in ways that they wouldn't have before.
And you mentioned when we spoke with you earlier, and I can't get it out of my mind, that counselors and psychiatrists have to be vigilant that they don't bring their own lives into the counseling relationship and increase their own stress. What's that going to be like now?
I think this whole incident will help raise the awareness of that and helping people to be more vigilant about, it's not bring your own stuff into the room, because you're absolutely going to do that, but being able to be there for the client instead of getting the client stuff in your head, you know, being able there be there to help them through the process that they're dealing with instead of letting that affect you. And that does call for more supervision, more peer discussion, all of those types of things that in times of budget cuts and increased schedules, it's difficult to do. But it's vital, as this incident shows.
Well, it's absolutely vital, and certainly it's a discussion that we're going to have in the days ahead. Angela Huebner is Associate Professor of Human Development and Marriage and Family Programs at Virginia Tech University. Andrew Pomerantz is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Dartmouth Medical School and has a long history of working with veterans and veterans organizations. And Olga Pena, Managing Editor for the Killeen Daily Herald, covering the story in Fort Hood, Texas. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we're following the events at Fort Hood in Texas, where 13 are dead and 30 wounded from a shooting rampage on the base yesterday. We've had, within the last couple of hours, a news conference at one of the civilian hospitals handling the wounded at the Scott and White Hospital outside of Fort Hood. Dr. Roy Smith has allegedly told reporters that one patient told him he was shocked when a man, quote, jumped on a desk and started shooting. And a portrait of the alleged shooter at Fort Hood is beginning to emerge now. Major Nidal Hassan, an Army psychiatrist, is 39 years old. He listed himself in Army records as having no religious preference. But apparently before being sent to Fort Hood, he prayed every day at the Muslim Community Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And that's according to the Washington Post, which has a profile of Major Hassan in the Washington Post. Christian Davenport from the Post with that story joins us now. What are we learning about his role and identity in the community of Silver Spring, Maryland, Christian?
Well, a portrait is beginning to emerge. Some of the things that we found out, is that you mentioned, is that he was a very devout Muslim who went to the Muslim Community Center in Silver Spring, which is just north of Washington, D.C., quite often. He was a regular there. They knew him. One of the things that made him stand out was that he would sometimes show up at the mosque in his uniform, in his army fatigues, and had filled out an application or some sort of form talking about, you know, the, you know, what sort of woman he might like to be matched up with, and had mentioned that he was interested in a woman who was also very religious, who prayed five times a day.
Any family members contacted by the paper?
Yeah, we talked to his aunt, Noelle Hudson, who's from Virginia. And she had said that he had endured some taunting and harassment in the service because of his Muslim faith. And that started after the September 11th attacks. And he had been asking for years to be discharged from the service, but apparently to no avail.
Is your reporting confirming what has been reported by other outlets, that there were perhaps websites where he expressed a criticism of the war? Again, no official connection here, but any sense that he was opposed to the war or opposed to his own deployment?
Well, yeah, that's a former colleague had said that he had talked openly about being against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there was a website that has a screen name of Nidal Hussein. I mean, there's no way to confirm that the major actually is the person who wrote it, but that on this posting on the website, it does talk about how suicide bombers are similar to kamikazes, and that they're sacrificing themselves for a cause.
And again, the only connection there is that the names are similar, if not identical, but no real connection. But in any case, the profile of Major Hassan is in the Washington Post, and Christian Davenport helped to assemble that profile. Christian Davenport, thanks for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Again, covering the aftermath of the shootings at Fort Hood in Texas, in which 13 service members died and more than at least 30 injured, all in the stable condition this morning. The one bit of good news.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry here. Coming up, we talk to the author of the novel Push and the screenwriter who developed it into the movie Precious, which opens in select theaters today. Right now, Richard Hake is here with a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour.
And John, we just learned this past hour that the unemployment rate has surpassed 10% for the first time since 1983. The jobless rate rose to 10.2% in October from 9.8%. The latest figures from yesterday's shooting in Fort Hood, Texas, are 13 dead and at least 30 injured. Families of the dead and wounded are being notified. Officials say many of those hurt in yesterday's shooting underwent surgery. 28 are still hospitalized. All are in stable condition. Meanwhile, the Homeland Security Secretary is calling the shooting rampage a, quote, horrific act of violence. She refused to say whether investigators consider the shootings an act of terrorism. Later today, President Obama will visit Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington. The White House says the visit was planned before yesterday's shooting. The World Health Organization says most flu cases around the world are the H1N1 or swine flu strain. The WHO's top flu official says in some countries up to 70% of the flu virus being tested is H1N1 rather than seasonal flu. Meanwhile, in Milwaukee, police have arrested a man accused of stealing a truck carrying 900 doses of the H1N1 vaccine. The truck was taken last night when it was outside of a health clinic. It was found abandoned an hour later with the vaccine apparently intact, but city officials say the vaccine is now considered, quote, compromised and can't be used.
Wow. That's interesting. Joining us now, though, is Amanda Lee. Her husband is stationed at Fort Hood and is experiencing in a fairly direct way the aftermath of the shooting yesterday. Amanda Lee, good morning. And your husband has just returned from a deployment in Afghanistan. I wonder if you can tell me how your family is reacting to the shooting yesterday at Fort Hood.
Well, we're relieved that he's okay.
I sure.
Mean, But it's definitely, you know, he came home in June, so you kind of expect that that you're not going to have to worry anymore at that point. You know, it's like, all right, well, the depression's over, and now we get back to our regular lives. And this is the last thing that we would have expected.
Well, you know, a lot of counselors that we've talked with this morning have described this sense of safety that people on base are going to have to get back to. How does that play out in your lives, in your family?
I don't really know. I guess it's a little bit different for me. I lived here on September 11th, so it's kind of like it's an adjustment that I've made before. But I think it's going to be very difficult for Fort Hood. I mean, like, I've spent a limited amount of time on the base, and when you go to Fort Hood, it's like an overwhelming experience. They call it a great place because it's just this huge base that you go through gates to get into, and you do feel very safe when you're there because it feels like it's all insiders. It's all military, and you don't have to worry about anything. So I think that's going to be a difficult adjustment for people who live in Fort Hood. I think it's probably a lot like the adjustment that people who were in New York had to make to going back to your regular life and feeling safe in a place where something very tragic happens.
Well, and as you say, Amanda Lee, you're really inside when you're in Fort Hood, behind those gates, behind the so-called protection. And, of course, the protection is what's gone today. Amanda Lee, her husband is stationed at Fort Hood, talking about getting back to a sense of normalcy after the shooting in Fort Hood yesterday. Amanda Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine. I wish I had a light-skinned boyfriend with real nice hair. But first, I want to be in one of them BET videos.
Now, that's how theatergoers are introduced to Clarice Precious Jones in Lee Daniels' new film, Precious. But it doesn't take long for us to realize that BET videos are probably not in the cards for Precious. She's an abused, illiterate teenage girl who's pregnant for the second time with her father's child. It's a story that was first told in the book Push. Joining us this morning is the author of that book, Sapphire. Good morning, Sapphire.
Good morning.
Also, Jeffrey Fletcher, who wrote the screenplay for Precious, which is based on the novel Push, also joins us. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning.
Sapphire, you know, this is a story. I remember when this book came out, this was an unforgettable, gripping story of violence and abuse told from inside the mind of a character that you never meet in literature. I can't imagine a more unlikely story to be turned into a movie. What did you think when you first began getting offers?
Well, I started getting offers in 1996. I got them from, you know, all different types of people in the entertainment community. I mean, you know, Madonna offered to do the film. You know, young college students were calling me, putting together collectives, offering to do the film. You know, so offers were coming in from a lot of places. One thing I felt, the book needed a chance to be a book before it got turned into a film.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It needed a chance to have a life as a piece of literature. It needed a chance to go from hand to hand. It needed a chance not to be turned into a fixed image. You know, like when you read the book, a million different people will see a million different Preciouses. When you see a film or a TV version of a book, you have a character. You know, for millions of people now, Whoopi Goldberg is Alice Walker's Seeley.
Right, right.
So
right, from
I knew
The Color
that,
Purple,
that,
right?
That yes, I knew that process would happen, but I felt it needed a chance to become part of readers' consciousness. Now people go to this movie with the book in their hand, comparing the book to the movie. So it's for many, many people, the movie is not their first encounter with the book. So they're holding the movie to a very high standard. And I don't think that would have happened if, you know, 6 months after the book came out, a movie had come out.
So Jeffrey Fletcher, screenwriter who adapted Sapphire's book Push for the screen. I mean, let's try an elevator pitch here, Jeffrey. 350-pound African-American woman who sleeps with her dad. That's not a pitch you take to Halle Berry, I gather.
No, it's not. And I really credit Sapphire and Lee Daniels for, for seeing that this is a character who's point of view is important, and a character who's beautiful, even if she's not, doesn't fall under the traditional parameters of what we've come to believe is beautiful. So, but I fell in love with her from page one.
Huh. Why do you think there's such momentum behind this project? You got Lee Daniels as director, you got Oprah Winfrey producer, you got Lenny Kravitz in the movie, you got a lot of people who are signing up to be a part of this, the soundtrack. This isn't a commercial issue, is it?
Oh, no. I think it all comes from Sapphire's work. I mean, it's so rich, it's so honest, that everyone involved originally and those who have come later have sensed that inspiration. And as Sapphire said earlier, one of the brilliant things about the book is that it is so rich, but also leaves room for people to bring their own perspective and passions and issues and knowledge to the canvas.
Well, a challenge for a screenwriter. Jeffrey Fletcher is the screenwriter who adapted Push for the film Precious. Sapphire, we'll go out with you. Can I ask you the dumb Hollywood question? Is this a story of redemption?
Ultimately, this is any story that tells the truth, that enters deeply into human life, is a story of redemption. So while we will see and hear some horrible things in this film, ultimately we will see a human soul being unveiled, and we'll see an inner world that we did not know existed, a horrible one, but we'll also see a magnificent one of transformation.
So redemption it is. Congratulations to Sapphire, the author of Push, which opens as a movie, Precious, in limited release today. And Jeffrey Fletcher, screenwriter. A challenge to both of you, but congratulations. It sounded like it worked out great. If you missed anything, we are always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. We're following the tragic story out of Fort Hood, Texas, where Major Nidal Malik Hassan went on a shooting rampage that took 13 lives. Reactions all morning from voices close to and far away from the events in Fort Hood.
The state of Texas has had a significant loss with a tragedy at Fort Hood.
It's very chilling. It's very chilling, especially because in order for me to leave post, I actually had to get a clearing stamp from that building. So I was just in that building.
When events like this happen, it does, you know, cast a dark shadow over it.
So much has happened to Fort Hood since the war started, and it's hard to believe one of our own could do something like this.
The voices of people on the program this morning trying to get back to that feeling of safe at Fort Hood, Texas, the worst shooting rampage in U.S. military history. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Have a good weekend, folks. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.